Welcome to Syndicated News. We're going to be featuring Dr. Richard Warshak. He's going to be talking about a project he's been working on for a few years. It's the Pluto DVD. We're going to be talking about that. And our hostess this evening, surprise hostess, is Jill EGZ.
Very good, Ruthie DiTucci. Thank you so much.
Dr. Warshak, you with us?
Yes, I am, and thank you for inviting me.
Well, we didn't have the opportunity to have Dr. Wardner, whom we were expecting for obvious legal reasons. And I'm going to take a moment and read to you what I would call, and has been properly named, 10 years of litigation. Of course, I'm not going to mention any names, adults or children or otherwise, but I just wanted to let you know that there's a wonderful case going on in Nassau County, New York, wherein a judge chose to a parent go to jail on weekends for 3 months, every other weekend, because she successfully alienated her children from their father to the point where there was no relationship. And we know that this is happening not only in the United States and Canada and Mexico, it's happening all over the world. And I'm going to read this to you because Dr. Wardner hasn't had a chance, and he's the only one whose name I will use. And here we go, 10 years of litigation. He's funded 14 attorneys, both to represent himself and his ex-wife. And he's basically paid these attorneys to further keep him from his children. There's not much else that he can do about it. He's funded no less than 9 psychologists. And I've seen these reports, and they range anywhere from $10,000 to $60,000 each. Once these reports are court-ordered, they're also not read, which is heartbreaking. There have been, in this case, 14 attorneys. It's run through 3 counties, Seminole County, Volusia County, and Brevard County. There have been 10 psychologists, 10 false DCF complaints, 6 false malpractice complaints to attempt to destroy this gentleman's practice, 1 false domestic battery complaint, a false concealment against a court order complaint. He's been jailed twice. He's had the cost of bonding himself out twice. There's been the destruction of the bond between a father and the children, destruction of the bond between the grandmother and the children, no contact or relationship with the father or his friends, all of them being made out to be people of ill repute. Father sets up gymnastics. Mother destroys it. Sets up piano lessons. Mother destroys it. Sets up children with skiing. Mother destroys it. Every day that he's scheduled to pick the children up, in this case it was Wednesdays and weekends, something else is scheduled in. It's gone on for years. The child support he pays is equivalent to a salary of $100,000 a year. That's $60,000 net, paid over year after year after year. And to make an even playing field, he also has to pay for the ex's attorneys. So there's absolutely no reason for her to stop this war. She has to keep it up in order to keep things going the way they are. And then he has to pay to defend himself in criminal court. That's how outrageously this case has gone on. I've seen many cases cross my desk when people have come asking for help or asking for a doctor or a psychologist or a counselor. This is one of the most outrageous, and it's going on in the state of Florida. But take heart, the tide is turning. You saw that judge did order that one woman to jail every other weekend for the next 3 months. And there's another case in which the judge didn't even let the parent leave the courtroom. She was remanded to the bailiff and ordered to sit in jail and wait till her sentencing because it's clear that she's a flight risk. And now, Dr. Warshak, please give us your insight on this.
Well, you know, we have to be very careful when we hear only one side of the story.
But absolutely.
We certainly know, though, that there are cases like this that drag on, that just suck precious, valuable resources. When there are false complaints, you know, there are very limited social service resources, and we want those directed to rescue children from abusive homes, not to be investigating complaints that are frivolous or repeatedly found to have no basis. These cases really do tax the system, though. And I think what you're, the cases you're talking about where a judge has no recourse but to put a parent in jail are the ones where the court must have felt that they had reached the end of the rope, because the courts issue orders, and if people don't follow the orders, then there's a matter of compliance. You know, what can the judge do to ensure compliance? But naturally, we don't want parents being thrown in jail. That's really not, you know, a very effective long-term solution. But it may help parents to know that the courts are serious when they issue orders, because unfortunately, in too many of the families I've worked with, by the way, I've worked with very, very many families where the mother is the alienated parent, where the children are rejecting their mother under the influence of their father. So I don't really think this is a gender issue. You know, many of these sort of cases that just seem to drag on forever, where one parent clearly is showing very little regard for the law, but there's no sanctions placed on that parent to comply with the law. So they continue, for example, not to produce the children when it's time for them to spend time with the other parent, but there's no consequence, no negative consequence to them. And then, of course, you worry about what lesson are the children drawing from this if they're aware that a parent is flouting the court orders, violating the law, and having with no consequence.
Now we're going to accept a call here that we've been waiting for. Let's see, our caller. Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Fine, and you are?
I'm Jane McNeil.
Hi, Jane. Dr. Warshak is ready, and so is Jill E. Cheesy.
Well, my question is, why has it taken so long for these courts to recognize that when this happens over and over and the father has had, or the mother, has had no criminal record whatsoever, they just automatically, when they hear this case, first of all, they don't want to know anything about PAS. They don't want to know anything about that terminology. That's my first question. Why is that such a big issue, the term PAS?
Oh, well, the term PAS is a big issue because the S stands for syndrome. And there's a real division of opinion in the professional community about whether or not this problem qualifies for the label syndrome, whether there's been enough good independent research to establish that. And I think mainly it's a big distraction, though, from the issue, because surveys of mental health professionals as well as attorneys recognize that this problem exists. You know, no one except the most, you know, extreme radical is going to maintain that somehow children are the only class of people who are beyond outside influence and beyond pressures to conform and whose thoughts can't be manipulated. Everyone knows that children can be manipulated to turn against the parent, and they know that very, very often when that happens, the parent that the children favor is playing a major role and is pulling the strings. So where the difference of opinion comes in among reasonable professionals has to do with how best to label this, and how much research do we need before we consider it a formal disorder versus clearly a problem in parent-child relationships. But I think everyone agrees it is a problem. So my advice is, when you're in court, focus on describing behaviors. Describe how the children are treating the parents. Describe what the parents are doing that might be contributing to the problem, both the favored parent and the rejected parent, and then allow the court to determine not what the label is to put on the problem, but basically, is it in the child's best interest to reject the parent? And if not, what can the court do about it?
Let me just say something. We did all court case, and what happened is the judge seemed like he was on our side the whole way, like he knew this was going on. He even almost jumped over the bench at the mother for not putting them on the plane at times. And I just, like, bringing this up all of a sudden, because there was no, first it was a money issue, and then all of a sudden it became like, oh, well, she said the auntie's up, and then she said, oh, well, the children don't like their father. And he said, well, if they don't, then prove it. And then all of a sudden she came up with 37 allegations. He said he didn't believe a thing. But as the years went on, 2 years I think it was that we were in court with this, the judge all of a sudden said, all of a sudden he just changed his mind, as if just couldn't believe how the tide turned, that he went for the mother, not necessarily for the mother, but totally against us. Just totally, it was just a very bizarre case. And we felt as though her ex-husband, now her ex-husband, was a police officer at the time, and she brought in her old uncle that was a bailiff in the courtroom at one time. We just felt like everything was biased, and nobody would listen to us. Nobody. And it's a shame, because now that relationship at the time has been destroyed, was destroyed for 9 years, and these children were really being mentally abused. I mean, against their father, and everything just changed in an instant.
Yes, it's so frustrating when the courts don't seem to understand what's going on or they're not responsive. I have a couple of thoughts about cases like that, because I have seen these cases that where it looks like at first the court understands what's going on and to do what they can to help the child overcome this problem and to put an end to any manipulation and undermining of the child's love for the other parent. What I've seen happen, though, in courts and among mental health professionals is that at some point they feel really helpless to make a change. And
yes.
instead of just saying these children are too old, we don't know what we can do for them, or we haven't figured that out, they start finding fault with the rejected parent. They start basically agreeing that in order to sort of justify doing nothing, rather than just saying, well, it's a terrible crime, it's a real tragedy, but there's nothing we can do about it, which would, I think, be a more open approach.
And of course, there
are things they can do that I describe in my new book and the afterword, a program that courts are learning about and parents are increasingly using, even with teenagers, where their negative attitudes can be turned around. So there are things they can do, but so many of these cases do drag on like that.
I think it's so important, too, and something that you said, Jane, when you said that the courts found was against you and sided with the mother. I mean, the only loser in that whole situation, obviously, was the child or children. And we have so many cases where family court judges are sitting that don't belong in that arena. They may belong in traffic court, they may belong in criminal court, but they don't belong in family court because they never practiced there in the outside world before they were seated on the bench. And they're not educated about parenting plans. They're not educated about shared parenting or how to allow and afford that child the best possible environment in which to flourish. So I think, you know, one thing, if you feel helpless at this moment, if you're still fighting this battle, one thing that you can do is step out and be an advocate and really work toward legislative reform and judicial change in your state, in your area.
Mm-hmm. Yes. As a matter of fact, we had a forensic specialist, Dr. Levy, in Chicago, mm-hmm. that testified for us, and the judge did believe him. He said he was his only credible witness, and he recommended that these children be taken out of that home right now before they are destroyed even more, the relationship between the father and him. And the judge believed him and everything. And then I believe that, like what Dr. Warshak said, it was just too difficult that in the long run for him to make a decision. This was just too much of a complicated case. He didn't know what to do, and he just left the children where they were and said to my husband, you know what, stop thinking about your adopted son who he has and think more about your children. And that's what basically the outcome was. And I really feel like it was just too much of a difficult case for him to handle at the time.
And that may be, especially if you've got children who are loudly protesting, not wanting to be with a parent. The older they get, the more difficult the court finds it to basically force the children to live with someone they claim to hate or fear. Now,
yeah.
I think it's ironic because in so many other areas of life, we have no trouble expecting children to meet certain rules in society, like if a child wanted to avoid school or avoid a doctor, we wouldn't let them have that choice. But
right.
somehow when it becomes a custody dispute, and particularly if the child is over the age of 13 or so, many judges are very, very reluctant. I think they imagine tearful scenes, scenes of a child being pulled away from a parent and screaming, no, no, don't make me go. But again, very, very recently, I was able to publish some articles on how effective courts can be when they take a stronger action once they've determined. For example, if the court agreed with Dr. Levy's perceptions, and Dr. Levy wouldn't give those without a thorough, comprehensive evaluation and analysis of the case, then if the court believes that, then the next step is, well, how can we accomplish that? And that's where courts need to know now that there are new interventions being developed and that have been in place that can help children adjust to that transition if the judge decides it's in their best interest.
Thanks for your call, and good luck, and we really appreciate you taking the time to call in.
Thank you.
Jane, let me say one more thing, and that's the importance of not giving up on these children. On my website, I have a series of letters from parents who had been rejected by their children and whose children ultimately do come back to them. I think it's a mistake to automatically assume children are going to do that. Too many children never return. And even when they do, it doesn't make up for all the missed opportunities, all the missed occasions, the graduations, the births of children, the weddings, the athletic events and recitals. Everything that is missed out on really can't be made up.
Right.
But there's always, there still is room for hope. Some children,
absolutely.
Especially when they get away from the favored parent, find that they're able to start thinking for themselves, and they sort of wonder about the parent they had rejected all those years, and they seek out that parent.
Of course, outstanding advice, and as an alienated parent myself, I wait for that moment where the knock on the door will come, and I'm prepared for it at any time. You always have to have hope, but I'm always an advocate for people living their lives and not dwelling on this sad situation and the heartbreak that obviously goes hand in hand with this horrible thing that we all live through.
One way to deal with that frustration, as Jill was saying, is to advocate for more recognition of this problem, for courts and legislatures to take a stronger view of a parent who would essentially emotionally mistreat a child in this way.
Oh, hello.
Yes.
My question would be, you know, I want to take a more proactive approach right now and start approaching professors and high school teachers to include information in their curriculum when they're teaching, like, psychology classes and family relations and child development. How do we get them to include information about parental alienation into their curriculum, and then possibly our children will be listening and plant some seeds of changing the situation around a little bit?
Dr. Rorschach, do you want to answer that?
Sure. Well, I think that's a tough one, because you wouldn't imagine that a teacher in grade school or high school is going to be covering too much of this very specific problem, even though it does affect so many thousands of children. For the most part, it's more selective, and I think what teachers would be looking for is maybe more general information that would be more applicable to the entire class, so that it would be information about the importance of parents shielding children from their conflicts and hostilities and not bad-mouthing the other parent, maybe even something about what it's like for a child whose parents get divorced.
Right.
Now, I'll tell you who needs the education are the counselors in the school, because they do need. One of the most frustrating things for a parent who's being rejected by a child is when the school has taken sides and has accepted basically judged that parent just based on what the ex-spouse has said.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very, very frustrating. And that's where I think the DVD, Welcome Back Pluto, can be really, really helpful, because it's a tool that the counselor can use with children and teenagers to watch a couple of chapters at a time, because the lessons sink in about how to understand this problem, how to prevent it, and if you're a victim of it, it motivates children to understand why they need to overcome the problem, and then what they can do themselves to get themselves out of the middle.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's important, too, that if you are willing to step out of your box and speak to groups or talk to people about educating about parental alienation and adversarial divorce, something that Judge Michelle Lawrence and I from Chicago, who's a wonderful family court judge and has been on Ruthie's show with me and Dr. Michael Bone, she is just revolutionary in her courtroom in dealing with divorcing couples and children of those couples and parenting plans and just trying to do everything to make sure that children are taken care of. But we have been going out and speaking to members of the clergy and have been extremely well received. The purpose of all of that is to keep people out of courtrooms, to give them an option of talking about the divorce and dealing with it in a respectful way as it applies to the divorcing members of the divorcing couple and their children, and giving them an investment in the future of their children so that they don't need that emotional justice that so many people need when they're in the divorce court.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. The system itself is really not set up so well to do preventative work, to prevent these problems from growing. And it's not very quickly responsive. It takes a long time to get your day in court. And by the time that comes around, the damage to the children has been extensive, and their suffering has been unnecessarily extended. So what Jill says is really that's the sort of cutting edge of finding out how the system can be more responsive, how there can be non-adversarial ways for parents to go through a divorce and to learn what they need to learn in order to protect their children.
Oh, well, Dr. Warshak, go on. The
Dr. Warshak, let's talk a second about your Pluto DVD. Let's talk again about who it's designed, what demographic are you looking for, and what was the purpose of designing Pluto?
The purpose of designing Pluto is get so much email from parents and telephone calls and letters asking, you know, is there anything I can do to show my children what they're going through, or I see they're beginning to turn against me, you know, what can I do to help? And of course my book provides a lot of specific advice and a lot of practical tips for parents. But children need some help as well, something that speaks directly to them, and they're not going to pick up a book, and Divorce Poison wasn't written for them to pick up. So the DVD was an attempt, it really grew out of initially our attempt to develop presentation to help in therapy with these children and in counseling and in programs to try to help children overcome their alienation and learn about it. We found that you can really help children a good deal just by teaching them about the problem without having to directly tie it to what they're experiencing in their family. Because children who are alienated or even at risk for becoming alienated generally don't recognize the problem, and they're really not open to learning about it. But when you have this program, and the age group is, we say children and teenagers, and we've been a little bit ambiguous about how low the age can go because we're just not sure at this point. It's still very new. I just heard from a mother today who showed it to a 10 and 8-year-old and said they listened with rapt attention to the entire program. Well, it's an 80-minute DVD. It's divided into 8 chapters. And the 10-year-old boy was crying at the end. He was so touched by the story we end on, which is part of what I was trying for when I wrote the script. I wanted to touch children. I wanted them to recognize that they can't just wait for the right time to come along to reach out to a parent they've been rejecting because they may miss that opportunity. And so we use humor, we use videos, we use photos to try to help children understand the problem, to understand what each parent does. We want them to have a compassionate view of the parents. We don't want them blaming the favored parent for brainwashing them. That's not what the DVD does. In fact, it helps redefine the mistakes parents make as mistakes, but we give children the opportunity to understand that they don't have to repeat those mistakes, that parents can teach children many things, but teaching them to hate is not one of the ones we want them to teach. And we found that children do much better if they learn about these problems in the abstract, and then they can apply it. They recognize what concepts apply to their own situation, and so many of these families, the patterns are so familiar, the mistakes the favored parents make, the way in which they undermine children's love and respect for the other parent, repeated from one family to the next, the way the children demonstrate that they've been influenced to turn against the parent, the hatred that the children spew, the trivial reasons that they often give for why they're rejecting a parent, the contempt they show, the resisting spending time, showing no gratitude for gifts. They stop calling a mother mom or dad, and
right. They
would call it that, you know, that sort of thing.
You know, it's funny, so often people will say to me, I mean, I talk to people all day long that are alienated parents or grandparents, because as we all know, alienation reaches its tentacles into every aspect of your life, not just the parent. It's the parents' immediate family, friends. So I talk to people all the time, and they just are talking about the fact that I have to stop for a second because I'm getting emotional.
Well, these things are emotional.
Sorry.
You know what happens? You get a form of a warfare, like a tribal warfare, where people line up on sides, either defending or, you know, attacking a parent or defending that parent.
Yes.
And that makes it even more difficult for the children. They feel like, well, I'd better take sides myself, and that way I won't be confused about who's right and who's wrong. And sometimes children don't feel like they have a choice. That sometimes the favorite parent will actually threaten the children that if you show affection to the other parent, then you're not going to see me anymore. It can be very, very cruel. I mean, after all, in general, if we see a parent who's, or any adult who deliberately frightens a child and tries to make a child feel frightened of an experience they don't need to be frightened of, we think that's cruel. Like if a parent told a child, you better watch yourself at school. Those teachers, some of them carry knives, and they may, the kids get stabbed in school. You know, I mean, we'd think, what a cruel thing to do to a kid. Unfortunately, in some of these families, that's the level of cruelty that children are exposed to. And then other families, the favored parent doesn't really appreciate how much they're hurting the children to put them in this bind. And it's very tragic when the entire extended family is rejected, grandparents are rejected, and you know what sometimes happens is the grandparents will die before the children come to their senses.
And that's what I'm really concerned with. In my case right now, my parents are 71, 75, and they're not going to be around forever. And while I always say don't set about your own situation, I am very concerned for my parents. And my mom makes calls every day and is hung up on or ignored. And I just, it just is heartbreaking for me, for them.
It is. And imagine how the children will feel as adults if they come to appreciate how cruel they've been. It's a terrible burden for a child. Some of them don't ever come to appreciate it, but those who do express a great deal of remorse for how they treated their parents and grandparents. In fact, that's one of the reasons I end the DVD, Welcome Back Pluto, with a story about a young man for whom it was too late when he finally decided to reach out to the parent he'd been rejecting, and how devastating that was for him. And then, of course, with the urgent appeal to children, don't let that happen to you. We may not be able, by the way, I use the word Pluto as a symbolic of, Pluto was
for
so many years considered part of our solar system, a planet, and then it was demoted from its status as a planet. So the word Pluto is a good word to describe a parent who's denigrated and rejected and no longer considered part of the child's family. And I thought it was also a good symbol for the distance between the child and the extended family, as well as between the child and the rejected parent. So we tell children on this DVD, it may be too late for Pluto, it may be too late for this young man whose story you just heard, but it's not too late for you.
How can they get the DVD, Dr. Warshak?
The simplest way would be to go to my website, and the page on my website you can get to directly is plutodvd.com, plutodvd.com, and that'll get you right to a page where you can watch a trailer of the DVD and read a description of it and then order it if you'd like, and you'll find many other resources on my website. If you just click around, there's a whole section on divorce poison control that includes successfully restored relationships and how those came about. We're trying to learn as much as we can about how to get these children who will have no contact to break out of this box that they put themselves in. Very often it seems as though the children started down the road where they thought they were just kind of mimicking what one parent said, but they had no idea that it would lead to the complete loss of half their family.
Mm-hmm.
But once they get in that situation, they don't know how to get out of it, which is why I think it's so important that the adults take charge, that the courts and counselors learn about this problem so that they can nip it in the bud.
I'm calling from Colorado.
Excellent. Give us, Dr. Warshak, your question.
Yes. Hi, Dr. Warshak. Hi, Jill. And I just want to thank you both, for your devotion and energy and to these, these poor suffering kids and getting the word out. And Dr. Warshak, I haven't been able to watch it. I've watched some of the DVD, but not all of it. But you offer so much hope, where sometimes it just seems, it's never hopeless, but sometimes it feels that way with, not all the elements that you're describing, with the fear-induced kind of actions of the kids. And just a severance with, I'm Pluto in our case, and our whole side of the family is true, you know, in this situation as well. We're coming up on our family reunion at the beach in July, and of course I always pray, you know, that the miracles will happen and my three kids will be able to be there, you know, and we'll see. But it does, I think what, and I guess my two points are just for targeted parents, that the more that you can connect with good support and surround yourself, you know, with loving people to get through the sadness, you know, of not having them has been just pivotal for me. And seeing all of you guys who, I think Amy Baker's program into schools is also another good avenue to help create awareness. But my other question was, going through the travesty of the court system, is one of the things that I see it would be very helpful, and I don't know if this is something that is realistic to expect, but if there was some kind of a psychological test that could pinpoint these kinds of almost, I would say, sociopathic personality disorder type alienating parents, that maybe that would be, it would definitely be helpful.
Well,
maybe curbing this kind of stuff earlier on before there's complete severance.
Well, let me address your second point first about that. About the, there really isn't a, you know, one test that can do that, but very often there are early warning signs that are displayed in the very preliminary stages of a separation. And if courts can learn how to do a better job of recognizing those, if lawyers could learn how to do a better job of recognizing those, so that they could get their clients into parent education classes that teach them how damaging and destructive that is for children, and teach them about the importance of maintaining contact even if the children begin to pull back and say they don't want to spend any time with a parent. It's not so much a test maybe, but just recognizing the pattern, the early warning signs, and there are programs now that are trying to do that, and that are trying to have an early warning system so that those cases that need that extra help there, rather than several years down the line.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm still here.
Okay.
Margie, are you there? Okay.
All right. Margie, your other point, though, is a very important one. I think too often the professionals who deal with these cases are so focused on the children, as they need to be, that they fail to appreciate the suffering, the horrible suffering of a rejected parent. And I think that's very, very important to recognize.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because not only does the child miss out on years of involvement, but so does that rejected parent and her family. You know, so the vacations, the celebrations, which should be opportunities for shared benevolent memories and to strengthen your family bonds, instead they become irretrievable missed opportunities that you can't add those to your family's history. And the way parents talk about this, make it clear, you know, one mother who herself is a child psychologist said that for her she's heartbroken. It's worse than that. It's an unresolved grief that's worse than death.
Okay, Dr. Warshak, let's take a moment and talk to Jackie. Jackie is an 18-year-old who suffered from the results of parental alienation, but she's a very bright young lady, and she would like, we could ask her some questions. Dr. Warshak, she's on the air now.
Great.
Jackie?
Okay. Yeah, hi.
Hi, Jackie.
Well,
it's good for you to make yourself available. I'm not sure if you had something you wanted to say right off the bat, but I'll tell you what question would be most on my mind, which is, what enabled you to reconnect with a parent that you'd been rejecting? How did that come about?
Well, when I turned 17, my mom was a little, you know, crazy, and she ended up having me put in jail for a week, and I went to the JDC for a week, and then while I was in there, my boyfriend at the time, he got in contact with my dad because my dad didn't know how else to get in a hold of me. Then I started emailing him back and forth, like my email, and we started talking on Facebook and stuff like that. His family, my boyfriend's family, went out to dinner with them one night, and then they, you know, they obviously thought they were good people for me to be talking to. And then about 6 months later, I ended up actually going out to dinner and, like, actually seeing my dad for the first time in a couple of years.
Wonderful.
How did that feel, Jackie, when you saw your dad for the first time?
I was speechless. We were all crying. We were very emotional. It's kind of like,
like, where do we even begin? Like, we didn't, you know, we just wanted to, like, talk. Like, all we wanted to do was talk, and we sat there for, like, half an hour before we even ordered our food. Like, we just sat there and talked about everything that happened and what my mom said and what she did while, you know, we were younger that we didn't see.
You had the sense that he had not been that involved with you when you were younger? Or?
Yeah, like, my mom would say that he wouldn't send us gifts for Christmas or for our birthdays or, you know, send us cards or even try to get a hold of us. But when I was talking to him, I found out that they did send us cards and gifts and other things, and my mom just sent them back. So after a while, they got, you know, they got fed up. Like, there's no point in trying because it's been a couple of years.
And that's unfortunate. So many parents, you know, they do feel like they have to give up because everything they try doesn't work. And, you know, some parents in your mother's situation are just so convinced that you're better off having no contact with your other parent that they feel it's okay to do those kinds of things. It's okay to hide the signs of love. And they're not focusing so much on how cool it is to make you feel like your dad doesn't love you. They're thinking they're doing something to protect you. Good for you that you were able to sort of break out of that and then judge your dad through your own eyes.
Yeah, that's what I really wanted to do. I came to, like, the sense because my mom, like, when I went to JDC, it was like nothing ever happened afterwards. Like, everything was back to normal, and, you know, you can't just say I forgive you for that. Like, that was such a change in my life. Like, I really didn't do anything wrong. She just went crazy, and I didn't know what else to do. And then, you know, when I was talking to my boyfriend, I was like, I really don't know what to do. And he sat me down, and he's like, your dad contacted us. And when I, you know, I hit that point where I, like, hit rock bottom, and I didn't know how else to get back up. And when I was talking to him, and it was just, like, such a relief to even know he was there, like, to even know that he even tried, because I didn't think he tried.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that, Jackie, because one of the pieces of advice we give parents, and now I'm thinking from what you're saying that we're on the right track, is to do your best to try to keep letting your child know that you're hanging in, you haven't been pushed away, you know, you haven't given up, you still love the child. You know, and unfortunately, your dad may not have had a means to get that message to you, but some parents do, and when they do, it's very important because, you know, kids will start thinking, gee, after the way I've treated him, maybe he wouldn't want me to come back.
Yeah, I thought the same thing.
You did.
Yeah.
And children need to realize that parents, loving parents, don't give up on you. You know. And parents need to realize too that, you know, that and recognize that children in your situation oftentimes feel like they just have no choice. By the way, what you described is a good reason for children to have two parents in their lives. Because sometimes one parent will get quite irrational and create a crisis, and it's good to have backup. It's good to have another parent there. Yes, go ahead, Jackie.
Oh, sorry. My brother, he was trying to be there, like be the, you know, father of the situation when everything went down, and ultimately he, you know, my mom said whatever she wanted to say, and my brother got put in jail as well, and that's. And we, within like a 2-month time period, both of my brother and I, we went, and he spent the night in jail because he was 18 at the time, and I spent a week in the juvenile detention center.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Jackie, what's your relationship with your mother like now?
Things are better than they were last year when everything went down. Things are pretty good. She kind of, when she saw my dad, because he came to my graduation, when she saw him, she freaked out. Like, she didn't know how to handle herself, and she was, like, out of her mind and irrational, and, you know, she kind of went crazy for a couple of days, and she's kind of back on track. But she realizes now that my brother and I are both 18 and we have every right to talk to him.
Well, it sure sounds like there was a big crisis that actually at the time might have seemed like the low point of your life, but it opened up the opportunity for your dad to come back into your life.
Yeah, and that's what matters the most, to even, like, have, you know, to see what people were actually there to help me back up when I hit that point, and my dad was there to even talk to me. You know, it was through emails, and it was every so often, but we both made that, like, attempt to keep talking.
If you were talking to someone, maybe a 16-year-old girl, who seemed to begin turning against the parent, you know, and seemed to be developing the same sort of problem that was going on in your family, is there any advice you could think of that you would want to tell the 16-year-old?
I would, you know, like, if your parent doesn't really want to talk to you, then they don't, but you always need to take that opportunity. Like, you never know what could come from it, because it's a good opportunity to take that little jump and just see what happens.
Right, and it is, it feels like a jump, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, it felt like a leap. I was so scared the first time.
You know, that's one of the reasons I tell parents, too, to make sure your children understand that if they take that leap, that you're not going to meet them with making them feel bad. You're not going to be, you know, yelling at them for how badly they treated you or rehashing
right.
the past.
And oh, yeah.
You know, are ready to discuss that, you know, that's
yeah.
not, you know, in other words, to just make it easier. It's hard enough as it is. So just make that time easier, and if you ever need to talk about the past, the right time will come to do that.
That's exactly what I was going to say.
Yeah.
Don't you think the best approach is to welcome them in and deal with it from that
Another
moment
time.
On, not going
yes.
back to what happened before, and then if questions come up, you deal with them at hand.
I think so. The only reason I was hedging a little is because, you know, it sounds like Jackie, when she first got to saw her dad in the having dinner with him, that they had a lot to catch up on and wanted to.
Yeah.
But I think you're 100% correct, Jill, about that you don't, and not only that, but you want the rejected parent to let the child know ahead of time that that's how you're going to behave, because
mm-hmm.
children are very afraid of that. So let them know, my door is open whenever you want, no questions asked,
yes,
no rehashing the past. I'll just be thrilled to have you back, and
that's
I'll
exactly,
never stop loving you.
That's exactly what my dad said, and that was, like, such a relief, like, knowing that, and it was easier to talk to him afterward.
You had to feel a little bit anxious and guilty, Jackie, about the way that you had treated him throughout that alienated time, right?
Yeah,
and through no fault of your own. I mean, you were told things and you believed them and you did
yeah.
what you thought you were supposed to do, but you can't welcome someone in and then castigate them immediately for things that you think they've done. So
no, the best thing, it was just like kind of sit down and just kind of talk and, like, catch up, like, old friends. Like, you sit there and you catch up. You don't jump into, like, why did you do this? Why did you do that? Because when I went in, I was afraid that was going to happen, and I was like, oh, my God, like, I don't know what to say. Like, this is what I was told. I, you know, you don't know where to go from there. But when, you know, you just catch up, it makes it a lot easier, and it's, like, a bigger relief. And when him and I do talk about it, we kind of break it down, like, little pieces. We don't, you know, sit there and try to figure it all out in one part, you know? Like, we just took it slow.
That makes sense. Jackie, do you have a sense for how your mother feels about your being on better terms with your father?
I mean, I she knows, but, you know, she's obviously not too happy, because then she realizes, like, you know, she might choose, you know, her father over me, and, you know, that kind of freaks her out, because, all she, you know, she's had my brother and I. And
right.
she doesn't know any different.
On this new DVD program, Welcome Back Pluto, we call that blowback. When, you know, when a parent, the child just gets fed up with all the bad mouthing, and, you know, says, stop
mm-hmm.
it, I don't want to hear it. And they sort of get frustrated with that parent. But one thing that I advise children to ask parents, and even at your age you could do that, is if you get the sense that, you know, your mom's really unhappy with you having this relationship, just to ask, well, are you going to stop loving me if I love my dad?
Yeah.
And most, you know, most parents will say, well, of course not. You know, and then that makes it clear then that, you know, you really don't have to worry about that. Because sometimes parents will threaten children, you know, if you want to see dad, you'll never see me again. But most parents
cheap.
Don't follow through on those threats. What's that?
Wait.
That's cheap.
That's cheap.
I like that.
Mm-hmm. It is cheap.
When my brother and I were younger, like, obviously we thought my dad was a bad person from what we knew of him, like what she told us of him. And whenever we'd get in, like, really, really big trouble as, you know, young teenagers, she was always like, if you don't straighten up, I'm just going to ship you to your dad's, and you'll never see me again. And that scared the living daylights out of my brother and I. We were so, we only know bad things, and we didn't know, like, then obviously she used that as, like, a threat, like, you know what, you're being so bad, like, I'm just going to pack whatever you have on, and I'll buy your ticket, and you can go straight to your father's.
Right, and so that would be a fate worse than death.
Oh, yes.
except you didn't know that he would have been...
He would have been happy.
Happiness. He would have been over.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Parents, there's no manual for how to be a parent, and sometimes parents make some really horrible mistakes. And it's up for children to sort this out, you know. And it's very hard to, because if a parent continues to repeat something negative about your other parent, you could start believing that it's true just by having it repeated so many times. That's the memory plays tricks on you that way.
Well, Jackie, I'm really proud of you. You sound like you are an extremely mature, forward-thinking, intelligent young woman. And
thank you.
For you to come out of that situation as well off as you sound, I'm very proud of you.
Thank you.
Yeah, you do a good job. You could do a good job of putting your thoughts and feelings into words.
Yeah.
I may contact you when we start working on our documentary.
All right.
I have her number.
Okay.
And by the way, Jackie finished high school very well and is now going on to college.
Good for you.
Good for you.
Very nice. That's great.
Leading a very successful life.
Thank you.
Yes, that is. But how? Imagine how sad it would have been if you had never sort of reconnected with your dad. Were you out of touch or in touch with his relatives?
I didn't talk to any of his relatives through everything. I just saw one of my cousins recently after graduation because I went out with him and his wife for like a later dinner type of thing.
So now you have more family to turn to.
My cousin's not even like a half hour away, and I would have never known that. I would have never guessed that, and I was really shocked.
And did they treat you okay? You know, sometimes the relatives have a hard time understanding this problem.
She accepted it. She, you know, obviously they talked about it before with her, and she was just so nice. She was such a sweet girl.
Mm-hmm.
It was so nice to even, like, know there was some, like, somebody, if something happened, she's, like, a half hour away. Like, I can go over by her.
Great.
That's comforting. See, that's something else that people don't seem to appreciate is what a tragedy it is. If you have a cousin like that who can be a support, can be fun to be with, might even help you out in a jam.
Yeah.
You know, that to lose that is a horrible, horrible loss. And that's one of the things that... people who write books like Jill and I do, we want people to understand that, because sometimes people don't appreciate, you know, if you lost half your family in an airplane crash, everyone would have so much sympathy for you. What a horrible thing to happen to the family. But if you lose them because you've been misled into thinking that they don't love you or they're not worth being with, somehow people don't see how much of a tragedy it is. And your words have really helped, I think, everyone who's listening to this show understand that.
Well, I hope so.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure of that. Being that other children in your situation are going to hear this and are going to decide, you know, to reach out. Not to wait.
Oh, yeah. I hope so, because there's so many opportunities that I would have never even had if it wasn't for them, and I hope that other, like, teenagers in my shoes can open their eyes and maybe just say, hey, you know, let's not talk about the past, kind of like, let's talk as person to person.
Right. You don't have to rehash the past. You just start from now, and you build your relationship, and you focus on the present and the future, and eventually, you know, you might decide, well, I'd kind of like to understand a little bit better how that process happened. Although I have to say, Jackie, it sounds like you have a very mature understanding of how that happened and how you were sort of led astray.
Yeah.
it's too bad that you have to suffer so much and have to go through the ordeal of going to juvenile detention and all that in order to bring that about.
But I wouldn't take that back for anything. Like, just being able to talk to my dad, like, I would happily go there if I had to, just to talk to him, because he's an amazing person in my life. He's always there for me, no matter what.
So if someone told you, oh, it's not possible, a kid can't reject a parent if the parent's really a good parent, I assume that that's something you would try to set them straight on.
Definitely. I would really talk about it, because I know there's some people who, you know, think that their parents aren't worth it, and, you know, I try to convince them, like, you don't know what's out there. Like, don't assume just from what you know, uh-huh. because what you know might be completely wrong.
If you take any psychology or sociology classes when you go to college, Jackie, you're gonna sort of learn more about what professionals know about just that, about why you shouldn't assume just from what you know, because you may not be seeing the whole picture. Your attention may be focused, like a magician focuses your attention on one hand so you don't see what the other hand is doing. That's how memory works. That's how attitudes work. So you can think you're sure, and then it turns out you're not. And psychologists have some really marvelous experiments where they demonstrate this, where they show you the things you think you're absolutely sure about, you're really making a mistake about. It's just the way the mind works.
Yeah. Well, good luck, Jackie, in everything you do.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you. I think we're going to be hearing about you in the future. Make your mark on the world, Jackie.
Yeah. Yeah. Ruthie, do we have a caller?
Okay, so what are we doing?
Well,
we're going to be talking to another caller. She's right here. And, Jackie, stay with us, because we may have more questions for you.
All right.
Don't go away, Jackie.
Oh, caller?
Pennsylvania.
Pennsylvania. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. When I was listening to Jackie, I asked the question, you know, if she was verbally abusive to her father when the alienation was going on. And I guess somebody wrote back, you know, she possibly was. And somebody wrote, well, does it really count? And I said, yes, it does count, but it's not her fault. After reading Dr. Warsak's book, Divorce Poison, I started to begin to understand why my daughter was acting as she was, which was very verbally abusive, calling the cops on me.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. The last time that I saw her was Christmas time, where we had a very good time the Friday, and the Sunday after, I went to hand her some money, and she, F this, F that, you know, I finally said I can't take the verbal abuse anymore from her, and she was going to leave anyhow when she was 18. But, you know, just watching this happen since she was 2 years old, not her swearing at 2 years old, but just the brainwashing from when she was starting at 2 years old, actually, I'm surprised that I was able to hang on for 17 years through this. I look back at my life, and it was one big stressful situation. That's why I think I'm so proactive on trying to find ways to tell teachers and professors and, you know, everybody that I know about this, because the school that I dealt with, her high school in Edinburgh, PA, was horrible. And I'm going to say that out freely. I tried to speak to the counselors. I tried to speak to the principals, and nobody was concerned. And that seems to be the rule now, it seems to be the norm that nobody wants to get involved.
Well, I think people are eager not to be involved. They have their own issues, their own problems, and are basically looking to keep to themselves and not keep anything else on to their problems.
Mm-hmm.
So I agree with you, and I think this is Cindy. Cindy, the email that you sent me the other day, I think, was amazing, and I don't know if you're willing to tell that story about the graduation, but that says a lot about what you've gone through, and how you have lasted this long is amazing to me.
Well, I did go to her graduation. My son is 25 from a different marriage, so he still talks to her periodically, but I went to the graduation, and she walked right by me, and I said, "Hi, McKenna," And she stuck up her nose, walked a couple steps, and very snidely said, hi, Dave, to my husband, in that kind of voice. And then she would not, she took out her middle name, which is my middle name, too. Every child had a middle name when they announced them. She did not. And then my son had suggested that I just leave after the ceremony, and that's what I didn't have a problem doing that as well, because her father's whole family and stepmother, who's been very proactive in alienating my daughter big time, they were all standing there, so I left. But my son asked her to go to the car, and he said, Mom has a gift for you. Here it is. And she very willingly took it. Now, and whether this is part of the narcissistic personality disorder symptoms, I do think that, but I think that alienation, especially as severe as this and other people's, turns these kids into those kind of descriptive behaviors, and it is so sad.
It is. So is she attending college now?
She is. I didn't even know. I'm getting my counseling, master's in counseling at Edinburgh University, and she was to go there. She kept saying she wanted to be a pharmacist. But what she would tell me and what she would tell them, it almost like she had to live two different lives, because always she had to keep secrets from me. So then all of a sudden I look on the internet and I find out she's going to Mount Aloysius College in Crescent, PA. And she's not supposed to tell me that. She did tell my son, but don't tell Mom.
Oh, what a terrible position for him.
I know. It's been horrible. And she knows.
There's nothing like finding out, and as I did about 4 months ago, that my daughter was at Texas Christian University in Dallas, right near you, Dr. Warshak,
mm-hmm.
and finding out on the internet where your child goes to school is not a fun thing.
No.
It's like a punch in the stomach. It really is.
Dr. Warshak, you should go speak where Jill's daughter is and make sure she's hearing.
Yeah.
But you have to say, come on, Dr. Warshak.
She may not listen to me, but maybe if she watches the DVD show, she'll get her eyes open. You know, sometimes college is an opportunity to rebuild these relationships, particularly if there's some crisis. Like Jackie had a crisis with her mom. You know, if there's a crisis that way with a favorite parent, that can help. When children are off at college, oftentimes they start reevaluating the past relationship, where when a child's 18, they're an adult, and if they don't authorize sharing of information, for example, with a parent, it's tough for you to get that information.
Don't you think, too, Richard, in so many cases, there's just some counselors or psychologists are not trained the way you are in this arena, and they know just enough to be dangerous about
mm-hmm.
parental alienation, and trying to talk to a child about it is not a good thing.
I think way too many of them are like that, and too many of them just assume that if a child has so much hostility for a parent, the parent must have done
something
to warrant that, to deserve that. And yet, you know, we know that's not true from people like Jackie, who come back and say, wait a minute, you know, I was fooled, this guy's really a good guy.
Mm-hmm.
But she might not have thought that if we were talking to her, you know, 2 years earlier.
Right.
So you're right. So the counselors can do more harm than good. Sometimes, you know, if your child is dependent on you, for example, for college tuition or something like that, then that kind of sometimes gives you some leverage.
Mm-hmm.
I often advise parents who are in that situation not to merely transfer the funds or wire the funds into the child's account or just pay the tuition directly, but insist on giving the child the check with the school's name on it, but in person, right? Although that sometimes parents will do that too, you know. But I do think there's hope in the college years. It's a chance to reach out. There's new people. There's roommates that you might be able to connect with. But it's hard. It's hard when the school doesn't understand. You know, that all you're trying to do is get in touch with a child who has been led astray,
mm-hmm.
really. And it's very sad.
Ashley in Houston.
Okay, go ahead, please, caller.
I just want to make a couple of comments. First to Jill, always keep the faith. Know that one day the door, you know, someone's going to knock at the door, and it's going to be one of your kids, if not all of your kids, at least one of them. In my experience, I've reunited with one of my children, started to reunite with the second, but some of those efforts have been, I would say, probably sabotaged. But I can say that my relationship with my daughter over the past year that I've just reunited with has has grown. It's been a slow process, but it's growing, and every day and every time I get a little closer. So I just want to make sure that you know never to give up. And
well, I never will, but thank you so much, and congratulations for your reuniting.
Right.
Thank you.
Can you tell us how that came about?
Well, it came about through basically my new wife, my second wife, made contact with a friend of the family and got across to my daughter that I wanted to speak with her. And eventually we got together and, you know, shared a meal and talked over a lot of different things that were going on, and it was pretty emotional. It took me about an hour and a half to drive up to her, almost 2 hours maybe, and I was pretty nervous for the whole drive. Actually, I was fine for the first 10 minutes in the car, and then after that, it was white knuckle the entire way. I was nervous about everything from not only how I looked, but nervous about what to say and how to act towards her. But I, honestly, once I saw her, nothing else mattered. Nothing that was said or done by her, her mother, anyone, mattered. The only thing that mattered at that moment was the moment I was in and how to make sure that it carried on in the future.
You know, those who are familiar with my book, Divorce Poison, know that I advocate what you did. I call it creating bridges, you know, to try to find some way to someone who can be a link, because so often the children, you know, they never stop loving their parents. It's still beneath the surface, and so often they just don't know what to do, and they can't take the initiative. So what, you know, what happened in your family was that, you know, a third party helped and created that sort of bridge, and that's all it took. Just to get you back in touch, and then for you to manage the situation in a way that was easier for her, and that did not create undue stress and that sort of thing.
Yeah,
I think
absolutely.
So many people search for those bridges. I know I did. I searched for a bridge for many, many years. It couldn't be a member of my family because my children didn't want to deal with any member of my family. And I looked for friends who I had gone to a church for 21 years, and so many of those people ended up not being friends. They ended up on the other side of the line and you know, on the other side of character assassination with an ex-husband. And it just was a horrible thing to try to find somebody who would be that spokesperson for me. And it never happened. And you are so incredibly lucky.
Well, I would say that it hasn't happened yet, because I firmly believe that one day it will happen. And
yes.
I'll credit my wife with a lot of support, because there was a time early when all this was in its infancy, all the alienation, and I, you know, Dr. Warshak, we've read your books years back. We started reading them, and they helped me a lot to understand the whole syndrome and what to expect, and a lot of things that were written actually did occur. Not necessarily in the exact same phasing and timelines, but they all occurred. But one of the things that really struck me was the ability and the amount of information that's out there on the internet. We found that, especially my wife, that's how she made the contact with my daughter's extended friend.
Mm-hmm. So the next step maybe is to have a family reunion and invite them over and help them appreciate what they're missing out on if they're not part of that family.
And maybe watch your DVD.
Well, I you know, the feedback I'm getting is quite encouraging. Apparently,
yeah.
It's really, it was done that way deliberately. We wanted to reach children on an emotional level. We wanted to motivate them to work, you know, to resolve this issue for themselves. And so I think it gives understanding, and it gives a face-saving way. I think it's very important to allow alienated children to save face, because really they are victims. It wasn't what they chose. And so it's important to give them a face-saving way. And I think one way is for them to understand how widespread this problem is, that they're not alone. And then to understand, too, that they're treating a parent with hatred or contempt has not succeeded in driving that parent away or removing the parent's love. That the parent's love is so strong, it's never going away.
And Richard, the DVD, Welcome Back Pluto, is, I mean, it's for younger children, but you wouldn't say that it would be out of line to show it to an adult child of parental alienation.
No, not at all, because it's also designed for adults, because we want children to hear what tips we're giving their parents about how to manage these situations,
right,
both the favored parent and the rejected parent. So it's really for the whole family, and we are showing, I'm getting some feedback now, you know, with showing to 18-year-olds, for example. I was a little afraid that they might think that it was sort of beneath them, but it's really they're not. They're just intrigued to learn about this problem because they hadn't really looked at it from that perspective. They're so embedded in it, and they feel like, well, this is only my family's like this,
mm-hmm.
And it helps them to see, you know, they can't help but notice that when we talk about what these children look like and how they treat their parents, how similar it is to their own experience, or how parents have really manipulate children into developing these attitudes, they can't help but say, oh my God, that happened in my family. And we don't, I don't advise parents to sit down right after immediately seeing Welcome Back Pluto and say, well, let's talk about it. In fact, I think in many cases it's better not to do that, just to let those lessons sink in. Because an alienated child is going to feel the need to defend against it and criticize the program. But if you just let the lesson sink in, if they pay attention, if they watch the show, they can't walk away without having more of an awareness of what they've done, and also to have more empathy for the rejected parent, to understand how painful it is for the rejected parent, and how unfair it is to hold that parent to a standard of perfection. Because, you know, rejected parents make mistakes too. They don't know how to deal with their children's rejection, and they feel devastated, and sometimes they overreact or just don't react in the best way. And we want children to understand the point of view from the rejected parent as well.
Okay, doctor. We have Philip on the phone. He has a question for you. He's a counselor in Colorado, was it, or Denver? Or?
Yes, Colorado. Thank you. Dr. Warshak, it was a pleasure having met you at the AFCC conference.
Yes, hi, Philip. I remember you.
Thank you for being one of the few voices of reason there. My question is simply, how do we help judges understand how pervasive the problem of parental alienation is? How can we help them understand the technical aspects of parental alienation and how severely it harms children?
Well, judges get their information in, you know, basically two ways. One is in education, so in you know, continuing legal education and conferences such as the one that you and I were at in Denver recently. And that's one way. There are a number of judges in the audience at when I was speaking. And so they learn that way. That's one way. And the other is through expert witness testimony, which is a very expensive way for the judge to learn it. But you hope they are more willing to sort of learn it outside the courtroom. I think it would help to have more research on the prevalence. We don't really have any good studies on the prevalence of this problem. We do have surveys of lawyers who nearly unanimously say they've seen this problem in their practices. And so that's information we need to get to the lawyers. The other thing is to try, you know, one of the problems for judges is that there are advocacy groups that continue to repeat the information that judges are getting these cases wrong, that judges are sort of routinely taking children out of good, loving, emotionally supportive homes and placing them with parents who are going to abuse them or have abused them. And that's quite an indictment of the judicial system. Of course, when you ask for the examples, you don't get them. Of course, on occasion, courts get these things wrong. We hear that they're getting them wrong when they don't do anything to rectify the problem. But the idea that just raising the explanation for a child's rejection, that perhaps it's not really warranted, it's a big mistake just to dismiss that automatically. And that's one of the things judges need to learn. And I think they are learning that, but it's
slowly, very slowly.
Very slow.
Would you care to comment on what I refer to as systemic bias within the court system?
Well,
one of the problems I see is that they, even when you bring in the proverbial expert, and they're recognized as such, and they present the evidence where a reasonable person can draw no other conclusion but parental alienation, and they see the damage that's being done to the children, and yet they still do not act upon it.
Well, you know, I think one thing that contributes to that is that some mental health professionals mistakenly believe, and judges do too, that when there's a problem like this, both parents have contributed equally to it. So that if a psychologist says, well, you know, mom overreacted when her child was rejecting her, and she yelled at her, and so now the child's afraid to go see her, you know, that sometimes the courts get it wrong, and they say, well, since both parents contributed, we're not going to do anything about the status quo, or they'll continue to recommend a form of therapy that's just shown itself to not be very effective with these children. So I think it's very important that the latest research on high-conflict divorces is that judges are educated about that, because we're learning that in a certain percentage of families, you can't just label the couple as a high-conflict divorce, because it's pretty clear that there's one parent who's very seriously disturbed and who's creating the conflict, and the other one's just trying to sort of respond to it as best as they can. That you don't always have two unreasonable adults. It just takes one unreasonable adult to create these kind of problems.
And a courtroom setting is the least efficient way to teach judges what PA and PAS are. It ought to be part of training that family law judges receive long before they get to the bench and begin hearing these cases.
Yeah, I think, you know, really varies. You know, the idea of bias, you know, one of the earlier callers mentioned that, and I'm sure there are some courts where that happens. What I see more often is that the courts recognize that the alienation is irrational, but they don't know what to do about it, and so they end up not doing anything that's very effective to help. And Jill's so right that the courtroom is the most inefficient way to use those resources. But also in different jurisdictions, you know, sometimes the judge is, a family court judge is low man on the totem pole.
Right.
It's like the worst assignment you can get, and you can't wait until you get promoted to a better court. Whereas in other places, for example, Dallas has highly specialized family court judges who do nothing but family law. They're well experienced, they're well trained, and they attend continued educational experiences where they are learning about this. But even when they know about it, it sometimes is tough to sort through, you know, who is doing what to whom. Oftentimes the courts focus on who's to blame for this problem.
Well, that's exactly it. I mean, when you have a judge in this really perverse system that we have saying, I'm sorry, my job is to pick a winner and a loser here. And when you pick a winner and a loser in a custody fight, all you've done is guarantee that the child is the loser, because that child walked into court with two parents and he walked out with only one.
Jackie, since you're still with us, why don't you tell us what the relationship was? How did you handle it with your brother? Did your brother and you stay close did it help you to stay close?
Yeah, I talked to my brother a lot after everything happened, and we didn't really know what to do. Obviously, we believed what we thought was true, and after a while, we kind of just dropped the subject until, like, just recently when he actually saw my dad and talked to my dad, and, I'm trying to, like, get to the serious talk about everything and how he feels, but he's very, you know, shy about these things. He doesn't know what to think, because he's under the impression that what my mom has been saying to him is correct, and I'm trying to convince him otherwise.
Jackie, I want to ask you a question that comes up quite a lot. When you were, I guess you were 16 when you were rejecting your father. Were you 15 or 16?
I'm going to say 13, probably.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
At 13, you know, children, that's when it started, or that was, because it sounds like you didn't reconcile with him until about 2 years ago?
It was like a year ago when I started talking.
Okay, so let's say you're 15, and you're saying, I don't want to see this guy. He doesn't love me. He doesn't send gifts. He doesn't acknowledge my birthday, you know, whatever. Would you have wanted adults like the law to say, listen, we don't care what you think, you've got to see your dad. Would
yes.
you have wanted them to say, you would have? Okay.
Yes. Do you, Richard, do you find that that's, do you ask most children that, and what do they say?
That's what they say. The children that we've helped, for example, the program we conduct is called Family Bridges.
Mm-hmm.
When the judge does decide, you know, I don't. Sometimes the judge doesn't even know why the child got to be this way, and they're not placing blame, but they say, you know what, it's not in your best interest. This is a good parent. This mother loves you. She hasn't done anything that makes sense that for you not to have a relationship with her. So the judge says, okay, you're going to go back and you're going to live with her. We have a program to try to make that transition easier for the children. And what they say when they're done is they're so grateful. Of course, they go kicking and screaming. They tell the judge, I'll kill myself. I'm not, you know, I can't be with her or I can't be with him because they've led to believe such horrible things. But afterwards, once they reconcile, they say, I am so glad that that people didn't take me seriously. In fact, what they also say is, you know what, I never really stopped loving that parent. I just felt like I had to do what I was doing. And in some cases, they say, I just figured they'd see through my act. But they don't. The judges don't always see through the act. When a child is so adamant that it's a fate worse than death to be reunited with the parent, sometimes the judges, and also if the judge appoints a lawyer to represent the child, sometimes the lawyer will feel like, what can we do? You know, you can't force a 15-year-old to have a relationship with a parent if they don't want to. But to me, that reasoning doesn't make a lot of sense because there's a lot of things 15-year-olds don't get to choose.
That's right. The other day, I serve on the Illinois Family Law Study Committee to revamp Illinois divorce law, and we have a meeting almost every Saturday. And last Saturday we had a meeting, and that committee has done a 360 on its shared parenting ideas after Mike McCormick from ACFC and myself have tried to educate them on the just great importance of two parents raising a child. And we were talking about different cases, and one of the female lawyers that's on the committee said, well, I have an interesting story. And she said, I'm a mediator in a case that a young man, 15, came in and told me he was tired of living out of a suitcase and that he didn't want to go to his mom's anymore. He only wanted to stay at his dad's. And she said to the entire committee, I just thought that was so great. We worked it all out, and now he just stays at his dad's. And I said, how do you think that mother feels now? What do you think her heart feels like that her son doesn't want to stay with her anymore? And do you understand that that's the beginning stages of parental alienation? She said, oh, surely not. And I said, that's exactly what's happening. And I'm sure down the road that mother will be cut out of that child's life because he's 15 and he's being allowed to drive the boat and make the decision that he isn't going to see his mom anymore.
You know, this is it's a tough one because, you know, cases are different, and although that scenario is a very familiar one where it's the beginning stages of the alienation, it starts that way and then more and more the child pulls away. There are other family situations where really the child is not pulling away from loving a parent, but the schedule, the parenting plan, just doesn't fit their needs.
Mm-hmm.
And so they may ask to start having more of one home base. In general, you know, children are better off having two bases because then they have two parents that
right.
they're fully involved in their lives. But for some children, they can maintain that involvement with another parent, even if they say, you know, I just don't want to spend as many nights over here. And particularly if they're an older teen who are more involved with peers than either parent, than they're involved with either parent, they still need their parents, and they still need their parents involved in all aspects of their lives. But they may not want to continue with the same arrangement that they had when they were much younger. And I think if parents are flexible about that, as long as it's not an alienation process going on, then that can serve them well. Because if a parent is just rigid and insists on their weekend, regardless of what else is going on in the child's life, then that could lead the child to start feeling uncomfortable with that parent. So there are both situations, but certainly there are situations where the alienation begins with a gradually saying, well, I don't want to be there now, or I have this other activity, and somehow it seems like everything else in the world is more important and takes a priority over spending time with your mother or spending time with your father. And that's when, you know, somebody is not holding this child up to the right values. Someone's not telling this child, well, what do you mean? You'll go see your mom and then work it out with her when you're going to be seeing your friends. In other words, to assert that the parent deserves respect and deserves the child's affection and loyalty. Unfortunately, that, you know, when that doesn't happen, the child could pull away. So it'd be interesting to see from this mediator what ends up happening.
Yes, I want to really follow that.
Right, because that poor mother's in a difficult situation, because if she protests too much, then that could be seen as creating more conflict with her son, and then the boy says, well, that's why I don't want, you don't respect my feelings. And
right.
Of course, that's what teenagers always say.
Yeah, I was just going to say, that's dealing with anyone from 13 to 18 at any time. So
and you always resent people telling you what to do. But nevertheless, you can't drink. You know, you if you're riding a bicycle, you wear a helmet.
And we have to thank Jackie, who's been such a gem to sit with us and sit through all this. Thank you so much for sharing the evening with us. We so appreciate you.
Thank you, Jackie.
Oh, it's not a problem.
And now we're going to take a moment to identify these wonderful products that are now available. I want you to take a trip to www.warshak.com, and that's where you're going to find that fantastic, it's a DVD, isn't it, Doctor?
Yes, it is. It's 83 minutes, because there's some bonus tracks. There's an interview with an alienated father. There's a trailer. But it's divided into 8 chapters, and the DVD program goes through the warning signs of trouble, explains why children become alienated, what parents can do to avoid common errors, gives a lot of practical tips for parents, both parents, and tips to help children, you know, avoid taking sides and for kind of being able to hold on to their own view of a parent without having to, reject one parent in order to show their loyalty to the other parent. We explain why children take sides with parents. We help them understand why children become alienated. And we also give some vocabulary. We find that it helps children and parents to talk about parent-child alienation when they have a sort of common glossary or common working vocabulary. So we teach about the continuum of disrupted relationships. You know, not every child is at the point where they just won't even see the parent. Some of them are just sort of disappointed or disillusioned. They have some misgivings. They're still seeing the parent, but maybe they don't want to. Or they may be blaming only one parent for the divorce when relationships fail. Almost always, both parents have contributed to that. So they may be in the early stages of becoming alienated, and what we hope is this DVD program will help them not succumb to that and recognize what they're going through and then be able to get very quickly restore a loving relationship. But it's also for the more severely alienated children who show nothing but contempt and withdraw affection or won't have anything to do with them. We really want to open up their minds. We want to open up their hearts. And this is our attempt to do it.
Okay, let's take a moment. And we're going to thank everybody for all these wonderful gifts. We have a few book giveaways. And we also wanted to let you know that on July 14th, Jill EGZ will be debuting her show called Family Matters. It debuts right here on www.vindicatednews.net. That day she will have her first show, and then she'll be deciding whether she'll be coming on twice a month or once a month or as needed. And we congratulate her. We so look forward to having the Parental Alienation show. It's called Family Matters. She's going to host it. It's going to be her own show, and we're going to support her every way we can.
Boy, that's a show I'm looking forward to hearing.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
We want to be a guest on that show.
Absolutely.
And also, we would like to again announce www.plutodvd.com. That's www.plutodvd.com. And if you need Dr. Warshak's services, you go right to www.warshak.com, and you'll find that there's a number there in case you want to schedule counseling or if you need advice on what counseling to find that's closer to you. Also, Monday morning, very special. You notice that the case surrounding Natalie Holloway hasn't really ended. That case with Doran Vandersloot has continued on to Latin America. And SyndicatedNews.net was the only show and Blog Talk Radio that actually had an interview going on with Santiago Chile News at the same time that they were arresting Doran Vandersloot and returning him to Peru. And the investigator that's been handling that case and a lot of the details is Bo Diesel. Bo Diesel will be our guest at 8 a.m. this coming Monday morning. So don't miss that. That's 8 a.m. June 21st at 8 a.m. to 9 a.m. Join us. That's enough for the commercials. Let's move on.
One of the things that rejected parents ask is, what can they do when they're faced with this problem?
Oh, yes.
And unfortunately, sometimes they get the wrong advice. They get the advice of give it time. Time will heal wounds. Let your child have a cooling off period. And I think that's what Jill was sort of getting at when she's concerned about a boy who suddenly announces that he no longer wants to be spending nights in his mother's home. So it can be a mistake to just sort of allow this to go on when it might be the early stages of alienation. And if you nip it in the bud and say, look, if we're having problems, we'll go see a counselor and we'll work on them. But the way you deal with problems is not to avoid them. You work on them. You manage conflict because conflict is part of every relationship. So that's important. The other thing is that sometimes rejected parents feel like they have to take the high road, which they should, but to them, taking the high road means never correcting the child's false beliefs. So when the children repeat things they hear about you, you just sort of change the subject or ignore them. And in my book, I give some very practical tips on why you should correct those beliefs and how to do it so you can do it without putting down the other parent, without stressing the children even more. But you got to figure, if kids come to you and say, well, daddy says, all you want is his money, or, mommy says you care more about your girlfriend than me, you got to figure that the children at some level are hoping that you'll help them make sense of what they're hearing, that it's disturbing to the children. They don't like to hear bad things about their parents. So I think it's important to give children the information they need to judge you fairly and to correct misinformation that they may have heard about you.
Okay, we have a question here for you, Dr. Warshak, from Texas. Please proceed, 0202.
Hi, Dr. Warshak and Jill. It's Monica Logan.
Hi, Monica.
Oh, hi, Monica.
My question. It seems like a lot of helping professionals believe that both parents contribute equally. Do you know if there are any studies regarding the perceptions of rejected parents if they feel this way? It seems like that it might be a reaction to what they're going through. It almost is a punitive stance.
Yeah, sort of like blaming the victim.
Right.
Very often the rejected parents make certain mistakes. In fact, they're so common, I listed them in my book, and nearly every rejected parent who writes to me, it says, I made every one of those mistakes. Because they're human mistakes. Not prepared to deal with children who are acting in such an... It's really a bizarre way for a kid who's loved you for so long to just suddenly... Sometimes this happens literally overnight. Sometimes the mistakes those parents make are misunderstood as the reason that the child is rejecting them. In other words, that their reactions are mistaken as the causes of the problem. And I think that's very important. There aren't very many systematic studies on how rejected parents sort of feel about this. Many of them at first really are just puzzled. They don't know what's going on. Sometimes they will put themselves through this mental torture of asking themselves, what have I done wrong? Do I deserve this kind of treatment? What's happening? Because they just don't understand the process. We do know that there are studies on high-conflict families going through a divorce that continue to go back to courts and all that, and those studies show that in a certain proportion, and it varies in different studies, but let's just say maybe about at least 15% of them, that clearly one parent is the more disturbed parent who's creating the conflict, who's acting in a very sort of rigid, negative manner, who's involving the children. You know, parents can have conflicts, and they don't have to harm the children. It's how they express those conflicts. When they use the children as pawns to express it, like the judge found in that Nassau case that Ruthie mentioned, then children are going to be harmed.
Sure. Yeah, it just seems like they have a lot of the helping professionals. It's almost a double victimization.
Mm-hmm.
When it might be the way I'm seeing it is maybe it's a reaction to a situation that they don't know how to deal with.
Yes, it is that way. And then if they get blamed for it, it's just and not understood, you know, or people who judge them unfairly, who just assume that if your children, you know, rejected parents are embarrassed about the problem too. When you're just talking to someone about their children and they say, oh, and how's your daughter doing? And you don't really know because you're being kept out of your daughter's life. You know, it's embarrassing. Very often you'll try to change the subject in order to just, avoid that. And rejected parents feel like they're living in the shadows of their children's life. And, it's a very, very difficult situation. And of course, they struggle with this horrible sadness. One woman said it's like her heart is constantly bleeding. And it's a very, very difficult sadness to get over because you never know how long it's going to go on, whether it's permanent or not. And so it's a tough thing, but it's a real mistake for professionals and the courts to blame a parent. You know, you really have to sort out. You've got to ask yourself, for example, was the parent always like this? Because usually, you know, some particular character flaw is mentioned. He's always late, or she tends to be talk too much, or you know, things like that. So you ask yourself, was the parent always like this? If so, you know, didn't keep the child from having a loving relationship before the divorce?
Right.
Another thing
and
to ask. Well, there's a sign. Another one is, are there any other children in the family who are treating the parent better? Because if so, that also shows that parent has the capacity to have a good relationship with a child. So, why is this one child, you know, not responding in a positive way? So those things are important to kind of try to trace the history of the relationship and then to see, are the children's complaints, do they sort of parallel the same, are they making the same mistakes that the same complaints that the favorite parent makes, at least, you know, and that helps you to sort of understand a little bit more of, you know, what's going on with these kids and with these parents. It's very tough in court, though, to sort out who's doing what to whom. Some of these things have happened a long time ago, or they're very subtle, what the parents do. So I think it's more important for the court when it gets to that position, and I agree with Jill, the more we can keep these out of court, the better it is. Mm-hmm. But sometimes you have no choice but to go to court to exercise, you know, your prerogative to be able to raise your child and to be involved in raising your child. And in that case, it's important for the court to focus on, regardless of how the child got to be this way, is it really in her best interest to reject her mom? You know, is this mother so bad that this girl would actually be better off being raised without her? Would we have removed the child from the home before the divorce,
right,
if the mother were like this? And of course, in most of these cases of irrational alienation, the answer is instantly very clear that no, this is a horrible tragedy. And that's what we've got to recognize. It's not just the problem. Sometimes therapists say, well, the kid's doing good in school and she's got friends. So,
right.
And she's doing well with her dad, so what difference does it make if she doesn't see her mother? Well, it makes a huge difference. There's tons of research. Everyone knows, I mean, it's just common knowledge now, that your relationship with your parents affects your upbringing, affects you when you grow up, and the kinds of relationships you have in as an adult. That's why therapists go back and ask you about your parents and what your relationship was like. Because if you had a lousy relationship with a parent, if you rejected a parent and have no contact with that parent, that's going to come back to haunt you when you get involved in your own adult relationships. And it's giving you the sense that when there's a problem in a relationship, just run away from it. That's not a good lesson either for kids to have.
If you don't mind, I have one more question.
Sure.
I noticed that both you and Jill mentioned, a lot with the courts, but is there a lot of cases that do not enter the court, maybe due to the cost or the parent realizes, the courts just aren't that effective, so they bother not to go?
I'm glad you brought that up. I think most cases don't go to court for that, for the, exactly the reasons, Monica, that you mentioned. It's so expensive to get to court, and to get to court and do it right is very expensive. To have experts come in and educate the court about the problem, to have evaluations that do try to sort out what is this parent really like, what's the other parent like, you know, who's doing what to the child, what would be best for the child. It's so expensive. And then even when parents do that, it's an agonizingly slow process. Sometimes the courts feel like, well, let's try this kind of therapy and see how that goes. So it goes on for about a year or 2 years doing nothing. And so then the rejected parent tries to get back in court, but it takes maybe 6 months to get back in court. And, you know, and it's so slow. I've worked on some cases. There's one now I've got in another country that's been going on for 6 years. And even when the mother when the court made the right decision, then it was appealed, and then it went on for even longer. So it's the system is not doing a good job.
And simply because
a judge
has an inability to act swiftly and make a decision about a case, it gives the alienator time to act, and that's so unfortunate. The laws and the education of judges is just at the top of the list. To change the system.
Yeah. Even
that's
the judges
true.
Are saying that. Even the judges are saying that. They're saying we need to do a better job. We need to get on these cases right from the outset. We need to be making the right decisions from the outset. We need to be getting these people the education they need so they don't keep coming back to court. And Jill's point is very important, that time is on the side of the alienating parent. If the child is avoiding a rejected parent, then they've become totally dependent on the alienating parent, and they start seeing reality just through that parent's eyes. And the more they stay away from the rejected parent, the harder it is for the child to want to come back. You know, they feel kind of like Jackie did, that they don't know what kind of receptions they're going to get when they come back.
See, I kind of wonder how many parents realize this, that the courts aren't effective and so they bother not to go. I mean, I'm not sure the studies or the numbers on it, but I would think that many are aware of that, so they just don't bother to step foot in them. A lot of them still remain alienated. Do you have cases that you work on where they've never been to court, other than just the original divorce?
Fortunately, I do. I do have them. I have cases where the lawyer basically advised the parent to, you know, walk away, it's going to be too expensive, or the parent couldn't even afford an attorney. We have more and more cases like that. Or the attorney said, you know what, this child's too old. The judge is never going to make a 15-year-old do something that she doesn't want to do. Mm-hmm.
Richard, Dr. Linda Nielsen and I were speaking the other day about the percentage of parental alienation in white-collar families as opposed to the lower-income families. Do you think when they're thrown into court and kept in that adversarial churning setting for so long that because they have the ability to pay, because they're then thrown into that cottage industry that lawyers, judges, and guardian ad litems and court-appointed advocates have created for themselves, do you think you see a higher percentage of parental alienation in white-collar families?
Well, you know what? That would be an interesting question to investigate. I haven't seen any research on it, and I don't, you know, I frankly have not even thought about that, so I'd have to think back to all the families I've worked with to see if that pattern exists. See, I wouldn't be getting to know about those.
Yeah.
You know, that don't get there. Well, I just don't know. What I can say is that when it comes to parents dropping out of children's lives, I don't know that we've seen that a dramatic difference in working class versus, you know, white collar class that way. So I think that even when people are not going to court, that if one parent sets it in their mind to basically keep the other parent out of the child's life, you know, they can do that. Whether or not
yeah.
the court makes it even worse, that's hard to know. It would be worth investigating.
I think when you add, especially in, and we know this isn't a gender issue, but when you're looking at a homemaker, which I find to be highly undervalued in the United States today, what used to be the backbone of America is no longer considered that. And when you find a homemaker who has been a stay-at-home mom and was married to someone and they are in that upper crust of society, I think you find that the men do have the money, have been in control of the money, and when you end up being a non-custodial mom, it doesn't fare very well for you in that sort of situation with the kids.
That may be, and particularly, you know, when you look at, you know, what sort of man gets that kind of that level of control. If it, for example, if it was a situation where the mother really was at home, did not work outside the home, was involved, you know, in the day-to-day routines with the
mm-hmm.
child, and then somehow the dad manages to win custody, oftentimes there's a huge element of control there. Oftentimes the father is angry about the divorce. He didn't want it. He's humiliated by it.
Right.
And he deals with that by punishing the mother by depriving her of the children. And in that case, you know, he's clearly not having regard for his children's feelings. You know, that it's not about the children. It's about getting back at his ex-wife who dared to leave him. And, of course, the problem is especially serious in families where the man is abusive toward the wife, and she finally gets up the courage to walk away.
Absolutely. And by abusive, you don't necessarily mean physical. It could be a verbal, emotional abuse, much like Dr. Susan Weitzman talks about in her book, Not to People Like Us, which deals with white-collar women who have this very same situation, maybe custodial, maybe non-custodial moms, but they are punished with the children, and their lifestyle is virtually taken away with them, and they become paupers.
Right. These men are sort of used to having their way and dominating the women, and for whatever reason, the women sort of begin to understand that this is really not a good way to live. It's not how they want to raise their children, and what they hear is, you leave me, and you'll never see your kids again.
Exactly.
And then these men start acting on that, and some of them can be frighteningly effective in court, in arranging situations to make the woman look more disturbed, to make her look more unstable,
mm-hmm.
It's quite alarming. Quite
and
alarming.
And I've said
power control wheel.
Exactly, and I've said a million times, and I wish I had a dollar for every time I've said it, but no matter how many laws we change, no matter how many Saturdays I sit in the Illinois Family Law Study Committee, or how much we work in Washington or across the nation to change legislation, there are still going to be narcissistic, selfish people like that who will use and pervert the system to their benefit and use the hearts, minds, and souls of their children as weapons.
Right, and they're consuming a huge proportion of the resources that the family courts have.
Yes.
You know, it's the other thing is I think it needs to be clear in the courts and in society that children deserve to have two parents. And that unless your parent is abusing you, is such a horrible parent that we think the child would be better off without that parent completely, then we need to take that seriously. So that parents need to understand when they're going through a divorce that the child's not going to divorce the parent. That the court is not going to tolerate that. But the other thing is, from society's point of view, we really need people looking down on a parent who would use his or her child in that way. You know, society's impressions and society's values can have such a huge impact on our behavior. You know, when I was growing up, fathers would never be in the delivery room when the child was being born. And all it took was a change in attitude. It happened quite quickly, and then it became expected. Well, the same way, I think it should be expected that when a marriage fails or a relationship fails that has produced children, that it's to be expected that the parents are going to do their best to shield the children from the hostilities and to not lay this burden on kids. And parents who fail at that should be seen in the same way we see parents now who you know, verbally or physically abuse their children. You know, when you see a parent speaking coolly to a child, you know, it makes your sort of blood boil. And we need to feel the same way when a parent deliberately turns a child against the other parent, and because then they're depriving the child of the love and affection sometimes of half the family. You know, it needs to be seen as an act of cruelty.
And Dr. Warshak, I see this wonderful outpouring of love and affection and care and millions being invested in pest issues, you know, dogs and cats, and I don't see that in the same investment in people being interested in stopping this nonsense of separating the family.
Yeah.
We're breaking up the family the same way we broke up families in the 1800s. The father here, the mother there.
I think we're at a stage in recognizing parental alienation that we were at years ago before people understood how much children were being physically and sexually abused. You know,
mm-hmm.
that people were turning a blind eye to that, and now we recognize how important it is to rescue children from those situations. I think we're in that same situation with parental alienation, that many professionals label it as emotional abuse, and that we need to recognize that children need to be rescued from it. You know, even children who are physically abused oftentimes will beg the court to let them stay in the physically abusive home.
Right.
Because they're attached to those parents. They don't want to go somewhere that's unfamiliar. There's all sorts of reasons. But the bottom line is that the court says, no way. Our job, our priority is to protect you. That's, I think, the attitude we need to have about the emotionally abusing children and manipulating them, that they need protection from it, and even if they initially say they don't want it, like Jackie, they will come back to thank you if you don't let them act on their own destructive feelings.
And I think, Ruthie, it's so important to notice that we're right on the cusp of people recognizing what this is. There are so many people coming out of the woodwork that this has happened to, that have been touched by this, and as I said earlier, divorce touches everyone. There's no one that doesn't know someone who's been divorced or they've been divorced, and parental alienation is oftentimes part of that situation. And that's why books like mine, The Look of Love, which is a novel about parental alienation based on fact, it's something that people can pick up and read that don't know what it is, that don't know what parental alienation is. And one of my reviews said, it's a great poolside education for people who don't understand what this is. And as soon as we can get people educated and aware, things are going to start to change. And I really see that happening now. And I think you do too, don't you, Richard?
I do, and I think the idea of using fiction to get that message across is an excellent, excellent tool. I think we need to have a film, a movie, a major feature film that does for this problem what Kramer versus Kramer did to the importance
I think you're
of
right.
fathers.
What the Blind Side did for foster care. I think
right.
you're exactly right, and that's why if anyone's listening and wants the movie rights, they're available. But we're looking now, and
I think there should be a movie about this 10-year litigation with the 14 attorneys, with four judges recusing themselves. I think this would make a heck of a movie.
Ruthie, I hate to break it to you. I mean, it's a really sad story, and I feel horribly for the situation that exists there.
Is it common?
It's no different than mine. I mean, I had
$800,000
later. You know, I mean, it's no different than Alec Baldwin's. It's not any different. They're all the same.
Wow.
The parental alienation case is almost exactly the same with a few different nuances, and they go by a football playbook of parental alienation, and it goes step by step by step.
Jill, you wrote a book.
I did.
Do the movie.
I'm trying.
And also I wanted to mention out there for these cases like this one, we're going to have Bo Dietl on the show on Monday, and I am going to see if I can talk to him about looking at some of these cases because they're fascinating, and nobody investigates something like Bo Dietl, so I am going to mention it. So mothers and fathers, beware. If you've been alienating your children from your spouse, and that spouse happens to come by any aspect of my businesses, I'm going to be handing those people right over to Dr. Warshak and Jill Egeezy, and I'll tell you, then I'm going to talk to Bo Dietl to investigate how you came to this situation and see if we can't do something about it to stop it.
Well, you know, Ruthie, that speaking of the investigation, it gives me another thought about one way to start trying to put an end to this is that some parents now are making civil suits.
Mm-hmm.
For the emotional damage that's being caused to them through this. And I think if that becomes more prevalent, that may also help. That may also help. In some cases, if people, when they win an award, they're placing it in a fund to help raise more awareness of this problem.
Yes, because these families are being split up, and basically here you have a father and a mother, and now you're making these children a one, you know, they are all one-parent families now.
Right, and it's important what Jill said about how these cases, they're so similar, so many of them, that
yeah.
you know, you can read comments on Amazon for my book where people say, well, I started highlighting your book, but now the whole book's yellow.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, and that's a very common comment. And so if it's that common to the family's experiencing, we need to get that word out in shows like this.
Well, here we go again. I wanted to let you all know that Dr. Richard Warshak can be found at www.warshak.com. And for those of you that aren't sure about the spelling, it's W-A-R-S-H-A-K. That's www.warshak.com. And you can find Jill when she debuts Family Matters. That's the name of her show, Family Matters. She debuts right here on syndicatednews.net on July 14th. So please do join us at that time and consider this wonderful new program that the doctor's putting out, the Pluto DVD. The Pluto DVD.
And Dr. Warshak, best of luck with your new show.
Jill?
What did you say, Richard?
I said best of luck with your new show.
Absolutely.
Very exciting.
Thank you so much, Richard. I'm encouraged by the fact that so many people call in and want to hear everything that's going on with parental alienation, and we need to put laws into place that encourage the maximum involvement of those parents to preserve for each child the joint custody that they were born to have.
Excellent. Well, I want to thank you both for coming to the show, and Dr. Warshak, you are, I guess you're on the record. You're going to come back and visit Jill on her show, Family Matters?
I'd be honored to do that. And Ruthie, thank you so much for inviting me for this program.
Oh, I'm so thrilled to have you. I've read your material, and it just shocks me at how serious it is and how prevalent worldwide. Well, we're going to wrap it up. Thank you all for joining us here on syndicatednews.net. Don't forget to join us on Monday when Bo Dietl joins us. He's the investigator to the stars, the super sleuth. He works for corporations. He does work on corporate espionage. He's working on this case with Natalie Holloway's remains. He is the investigator of investigators. So thank you both for joining us, and we'll say good night here
at
Syndicate News. Good night, Dr. Warshak.
Good night to you, too.
Good night. Good night, Jill.
Good night, Ruby. Good night,
Richard.
Thank you.